7. The Rebel Defiant. Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. Henry David Thoreau, Civil Disobedience. A British police officer in a black Kevlar vest stood on the steps of the red brick row house on Hans Crescent that housed the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Another officer was stationed on a narrow side street, facing the iconic department store Harrods, half a block away on Brompton Road. A third officer peered out the window of a neighboring high-rise building a few feet from the modest ground-floor suite occupied by the embassy. A white police communications van with a rooftop array of antennas was parked in front of the building. I was greeted when I entered the lobby by a fourth police officer stationed immediately outside the door of the embassy suite. By the time I arrived, the cost of this round-the-clock vigilance by the Metropolitan Police Service, MPS, or Scotland Yard, at the embassy where Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, took refuge on June 19, 2012, had exceeded $1 million. The police presence and the communications van, which most likely intercepted all forms of electronic communications in and out of the embassy, were the visible tips of the claws poking above the surface of the vast, secret global security and surveillance monster that has cornered Assange and obliterated our privacy. An array of governmental and intelligence agencies from around the globe are working to destroy WikiLeaks and wrest Assange from the embassy so that he can be extradited to the United States, tried, and imprisoned. I was buzzed into the modest Ecuadorian embassy suite. I passed through a metal detector. An embassy employee escorted me, after I had turned over my cell phone, to the back room. Assange was seated at a small table surrounded by leatherette chairs. The room was cluttered with cables and computer equipment. He had a full head of gray hair and gray stubble on his face. He was wearing a traditional white-embroidered Ecuadorian shirt. Britain had rejected an Ecuadorian request that Assange be granted safe passage to an airport. Because he could not get to the airport, he was trapped in an embassy room. Assange said it was like being in a space station. It was hard to envision how he will ever walk out to freedom. Assange, Chelsea Manning, and WikiLeaks, by making public in 2010 500,000 internal documents from the Pentagon and the State Department, along with the 2007 video of U.S. helicopter pilots gunning down Iraqi civilians, including children and two Reuters journalists, exposed the empire's hypocrisy and indiscriminate violence, as well as its use of torture, lies, bribery, and crude tactics of intimidation. WikiLeaks fulfilled the most important role of a press when it turned a floodlight on the inner workings of the powerful, and for this, it has become empire's most coveted prey. All those around the globe with the computer skills and inclination to make public the secrets of empire, from Jeremy Hammond to Edward Snowden, are targeted. Australian diplomatic cables obtained by the Sydney Morning Herald described the U.S. campaign against Assange and WikiLeaks as unprecedented both in its scale and nature. The size of the operation was also hinted at in offhand statements made during Manning's pretrial hearing and reported by journalist Alexa O'Brien. According to O'Brien, the U.S. Justice Department considered paying the contractor Mantech of Fairfax, Virginia, $1 million to $2 million for a computer system that, from the tender, appears to have been designed to exclusively handle the WikiLeaks prosecution documents. The government line item is oblique. It refers only to WikiLeaks software and hardware maintenance. At least a dozen U.S. governmental agencies, including the Pentagon, the FBI, the Army's Criminal Investigative Department, the Justice Department, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the Diplomatic Security Service, are assigned to the WikiLeaks case, while the CIA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence are assigned to track down WikiLeaks' supposed breaches of security. The global assault, which saw Australia, after pressure from Washington, threaten to revoke Assange's passport, is part of the terrifying metamorphosis of the war on terror into a war on civil liberties. The dragnet has swept up any person or organization that fits the profile of those who can burrow into the archives of power and disseminate it to the public. It no longer matters if they have committed a crime. Aaron Schwartz, an internet activist, was arrested in January 2011 for downloading roughly 5 million academic articles and documents from JSTOR, an online clearinghouse for scholarly journals. Schwartz was charged by federal prosecutors with 2 counts of wire fraud and 11 violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The charges carried the threat of $1 million in fines and 35 years in prison. Schwartz committed suicide. Barrett Brown, a journalist who specializes in military and intelligence contractors and is associated with the group Anonymous, which has mounted cyber attacks on government agencies at the local and federal levels, was arrested in September 2012. He entered a guilty plea to 3 counts after the government dropped some of the worst charges. He was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison. Also arrested has been Jeremy Hammond, a political activist who provided WikiLeaks with 5.5 million emails between the security firm Strategic Forecasting, Stratfor, and its clients. Brown and Hammond were both arrested after being entrapped by an informant named Hector Xavier Monsegur, known as Sabu. Assange told me that he believed Sabu also attempted to entrap WikiLeaks while under FBI supervision. Manning was also entrapped by an FBI informant, Adrian Lamo. Monsegur, who by the government's calculations took part in computer hacker attacks on more than 250 public and private entities at a cost of up to $50 million in damages, was released from a Manhattan courtroom in May 2014 after Judge Loretta Preska, who had previously sentenced Hammond to 10 years, saluted his extraordinary cooperation with the FBI. The government told the court that Monsegur had helped to identify and convict 8 of his peers in the Anonymous and LulzSec hacker collectives. Judge Preska sentenced him to time served. He had spent 7 months in prison in 2013, plus a year's supervised release. This was in exchange for working for 3 years as a federal informant. He had been facing a maximum sentence of more than 26 years. With their fluency in computers and experience as the first victims of wholesale surveillance, WikiLeaks collaborators or supporters understood, before the rest of us, the reach of the security and surveillance organs. Those associated with WikiLeaks are routinely stopped, often at international airports, and attempts are made to recruit them as informants. Jeremy Zimmerman, Smari McCarthy, Jacob Applebaum, David House, and one of Assange's lawyers, Jennifer Robinson, have all been approached or interrogated by state security. The tactics are often heavy-handed. McCarthy, an Icelander and WikiLeaks activist, was detained and extensively questioned when he entered the United States. Soon afterward, 3 men who identified themselves as being from the FBI approached McCarthy in Washington, attempted to recruit him as an informant, and gave him instructions on how to spy on WikiLeaks. On August 23, 2011, Sigurdur Þórðarson, a young Icelandic WikiLeaks activist, emailed the American embassy in Reykjavik. The following day, 8 FBI agents landed in Iceland on a private jet. The team told the Icelandic government that it had discovered a plan by Anonymous to hack into Icelandic government computers and proposed to help thwart it. But it was soon clear that the team had come with a different agenda. The Americans spent the next few days in flagrant violation of Icelandic sovereignty, interrogating Þórðarson in various Reykjavik hotel rooms. The Icelandic Ministry of the Interior, suspecting that the U.S. investigation was an attempt to frame Assange, expelled the team from the country. The FBI took Þórðarson to Washington, D.C. for 4 days of further interrogation. Þórðarson appears to have decided to cooperate with the FBI. It was reported in the Icelandic press that in March 2012 he went to Denmark, where he received about $5,000 in petty cash after handing over the stolen WikiLeaks files to the FBI. There have been secret search orders for information from internet service providers, including Twitter, Google, and Sonic, and information about Assange and WikiLeaks has been seized from the company Dynadot, a domain name registrar and web host. Assange told me that his suitcase and computer were stolen on a flight from Sweden to Germany on September 27, 2010. He said that his bank cards were blocked and that MoneyBookers, WikiLeaks' primary donation account, was shut down after being placed on a blacklist in Australia and a watch list in the United States. Following denunciations of WikiLeaks by the U.S. government, financial service companies, including Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Bank of America, Western Union, and American Express, blacklisted the organization. And he said that denial of service attacks on WikiLeaks' infrastructure have been frequent and massive. All this has come with a well-orchestrated campaign of character assassination against Assange, including mischaracterizations of the sexual misconduct case brought against him by Swedish police. Assange sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy after exhausting his fight to avoid extradition from the United Kingdom to Sweden over the sexual misconduct charges. He and his lawyers contend that an extradition to Sweden would mean an extradition to the United States. And even if Sweden refused to comply with U.S. demands for Assange, kidnapping or extraordinary rendition would remain an option for Washington. Kidnapping was given legal cover by a 1989 memorandum issued by the Justice Department stating that the FBI may use its statutory authority to investigate and arrest individuals for violating United States law, even if the FBI's actions contravene customary international law, and that an arrest that is inconsistent with international or foreign law does not violate the Fourth Amendment. This is a stunning example of the corporate state's Orwellian doublespeak. The persecution of Assange and WikiLeaks and the practice of extraordinary rendition embody the evisceration of the Fourth Amendment, which was designed to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures and requires any warrant to be judicially sanctioned and supported by probable cause. Take the case of two Swedes and a Briton who were seized by the United States in August 2012 somewhere in Africa. It is assumed to have been in Somalia and held in one of our black sites. They suddenly reappeared, with the Briton stripped of his citizenship, in a Brooklyn courtroom in December 2012 and facing terrorism charges. Sweden, rather than object to the extradition of its two citizens, dropped the Swedish charges against the prisoners to permit the rendition to occur. The prisoners, the Washington Post reported, were secretly indicted by a federal grand jury 2 months after being seized. Assange, who said he worked most of the night and slept into the late afternoon, was pale, although he was using an ultraviolet light to make up for getting no sunlight. A treadmill was tilted up against the wall of his quarters. He had set it up so he could run 3 to 5 miles a day. He practiced calisthenics and boxing with a personal trainer. He was lanky at 6 feet 2 inches tall and exuded a raw, nervous energy. He leapt, sometimes disconcertingly, from topic to topic, idea to idea, his words rushing to keep up with his cascading thoughts. He worked with a small staff and had a steady stream of visitors, including celebrities such as Lady Gaga. When the Ecuadorian ambassador, Ana Alban Mora, and Bianca Jagger showed up late one afternoon, Assange pulled down glasses and poured everyone whiskey from a stock of liquor he kept in a cabinet. Jagger wanted to know how to protect her website from hackers. Assange told her to make a lot of backup copies. Assange, who attempted to run for a seat in Australia's upper house of parliament from his refuge, was communicating with his global network of associates and supporters up to 17 hours a day through numerous cell phones and a collection of laptop computers. He encrypted his communications. He religiously shredded anything put down on paper. But it was a difficult existence. The frequent movements of the police cordon outside his window disrupted his sleep, and he missed his son, whom he had raised as a single father. He may also have a daughter, but he did not speak publicly about his children, refusing to disclose their ages or where they live. His family, he said, had received death threats. He had not seen his children since his legal troubles started. As a child, he grew up without television and moved from city to city with his stepfather and mother in a theater group that at times involved puppets. In one play called The Brain, a plaster mold of Assange's head was cast for each play. He breathed through straws inserted up his nose, and then the plastic mold was smashed during the performance. He told me that he disliked actors because of their thirst for adulation and applause. He had more time for directors. He attended 37 different schools as a child, he said, and went on to study math and physics at university. Assange saw WikiLeaks's primary role as giving a voice to the victims of U.S. wars and proxy wars by using leaked documents to tell their stories. The release of the Afghan and Iraq war logs, Assange said, disclosed the extent of civilian death and suffering, as well as the plethora of lies told by the Pentagon and the state to conceal the human toll. He added that the logs also unmasked the bankruptcy of the traditional press and its obsequious service as war propagandists. There were 90,000 records in the Afghan war logs, Assange said. We had to look at different angles in the material to add up the number of civilians who had been killed. We studied the records. We ranked events different ways. I wondered if we could find out the largest number of civilians killed in a single event. It turned out that this occurred during Operation Medusa, led by Canadian forces in September 2006. The U.S.-backed local government was quite corrupt. The Taliban was, in effect, the political opposition and had a lot of support. The locals rose up against the government. Most of the young men in the area, from a political perspective, were Taliban. There was a government crackdown that encountered strong resistance. ISAF, the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force, carried out a big sweep. It went house to house. Then an American soldier was killed. They called in an AC-130 gunship. This is a C-130 cargo plane refitted with cannons on the side. It circled overhead and rained down shells. The war logs say 181 enemy were killed. The logs also say there were no wounded or captured. It was a significant massacre. This event, the day when the largest number of people were killed in Afghanistan, has never been properly investigated by the old media. Operation Medusa, which was carried out 20 miles west of Kandahar, took the lives of 4 Canadian soldiers and involved some 2,000 NATO and Afghan troops. It was one of the largest military operations by the ISAF in the Kandahar region. Assange searched for accounts by reporters who were on the scene. What he discovered appalled him. An embedded Canadian reporter, Graham Smith of the Toronto Globe and Mail, used these words on a Canadian military website to describe his experiences during Operation Medusa, one of the most intense experiences of my life. Smith wrote about traveling with a Canadian platoon that called themselves the Nomads. They'd even made up these little patches for their uniforms that said Nomads on them, he remembered. The Nomads took me in and they sort of made me one of them. He said he spent 2 weeks with the Nomads, used a bucket to wash himself and his clothes, and slept in his flak jacket. Smith talked about being under fire together and said that they gave me a little Nomads patch that I attached to my flak jacket. Assange's point is correct. In every conflict I covered as a war correspondent, the press of the nation at war was an enthusiastic part of the machine, cheerleaders for slaughter and tireless myth-makers for the nation and the military. The few renegades within the press who refuse to wave the flag and lionize the troops become pariahs in newsrooms and find themselves attacked, like Assange and Manning, by the state. There is no free press without a willingness to defy law and expose the abuses and lies carried out by the powerful. The Pentagon Papers, released to the New York Times in 1971, as well as the Times' Pulitzer-winning 2005 exposure of the warrantless wiretapping of U.S. citizens by the National Security Agency, made public information that had been classified as top secret, a classification more restricted than the lower-level secret designation of the documents released by WikiLeaks. But as the traditional press atrophies with dizzying speed, crippled by Barack Obama's use of the Espionage Act 7 times since 2009 to target whistleblowers, including Edward Snowden, our last hope lies with rebels such as Manning, Assange, Hammond, and Snowden. WikiLeaks released after-action reports authored by U.S. diplomats and the U.S. military. The cables invariably put a pro-unit or pro-U.S. spin on events. The reality is usually much worse. Those counted as dead enemy combatants are often civilians. Military units use after-action reports to justify or hide inappropriate behavior. And despite the heated rhetoric of the state about American lives being endangered by WikiLeaks exposures, there has been no evidence that any action of WikiLeaks has cost lives. Then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, in a 2010 letter to Senator Carl Levin, conceded this point. The initial assessment in no way discounts the risk to national security. However, the review to date has not revealed any sensitive intelligence sources and methods compromised by the disclosure. The New York Times, The Guardian, El País, Le Monde, and Der Spiegel printed redacted copies of some of the WikiLeaks files, but they have underreported the prosecution of Manning and entrapment of Assange. Do these news organizations believe that if the state shuts down organizations such as WikiLeaks and imprisons Manning and Assange, traditional news outlets will be left alone? Can't they connect the dots between the prosecutions of government whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, warrantless wiretapping, the monitoring of communications, and the persecution of Manning, Assange, and Snowden? Haven't they realized that this is a war by a global corporate elite, not against an organization or an individual, but against liberty, the freedom of the press, and democracy itself? The national security state can try to reduce our activity, Assange said. It can close the noose a little tighter. But there are three forces working against it. The first is the massive surveillance required to protect its communication, including the nature of its cryptology. In the military, everyone now has an ID card with a little chip on it, so you know who is logged into what. A system this vast is prone to deterioration and breakdown. Secondly, there is widespread knowledge not only of how to leak, but how to leak and not be caught, how to even avoid suspicion that you are leaking. The military and intelligence systems collect a vast amount of information and move it around quickly. This means you can also get it out quickly. There will always be people within the system that have an agenda to defy authority. Yes, there are general deterrents, such as when the DOJ, Department of Justice, prosecutes and indicts someone. They can discourage people from engaging in this behavior, but the opposite is also true. When that behavior is successful, it is an example. It encourages others. This is why they want to eliminate all who provide this encouragement. The medium-term perspective is very good, he declared. The education of young people takes place on the Internet. You cannot hire anyone who is skilled in any field without them having been educated on the Internet. The military, the CIA, the FBI, all have no choice but to hire from a pool of people that have been educated on the Internet. This means they are hiring our moles in vast numbers. And this means that these organizations will see their capacity to control information diminish as more and more people with our values are hired. The long term, however, may not be as sanguine. Assange wrote a book with three co-authors, Jacob Applebaum, Andy Muller-Magoon, and Jeremy Zimmerman, called Cypherpunks, Freedom and the Future of the Internet. It warns that we are galloping into a new transnational dystopia. As Assange says in the book, we are living under martial law as far as our communications are concerned. We just can't see the tanks, but they are there. To that degree, the Internet, which was supposed to be a civilian space, has become a militarized space. The Internet has become not only a tool to educate, they write, but the mechanism to cement into place a postmodern surveillance dystopia that is supranational and dominated by global corporate power. This new system of global control will merge global humanity into one giant grid of mass surveillance and mass control. It is only through encryption that we can protect ourselves, Assange and his co-authors argue, and it is only by breaking through the digital walls of secrecy erected by the power elite that we can expose power. What they fear, however, is the possibility that the corporate state will eventually effectively harness the power of the Internet to shut down dissent. The Internet, our greatest tool of emancipation, Assange writes, has been transformed into the most dangerous facilitator of totalitarianism we have ever seen. And yet, Assange continues to resist. His gloomy vision of a future when all privacy will be eradicated is in stark contrast to the utopian rebellions in the past that promised a new heaven and a new earth. He is acutely aware that his chances of escaping from the clutches of the security apparatus he can see out the windows of the embassy are very slim. Washington almost certainly has a sealed grand jury indictment prepared against him. Chelsea Manning, like Assange, did not have a stable childhood. Her difficulties with alcoholic parents, the questioning of her sexuality, and her small stature, she is slight and 5'2" tall, all combined with her intelligence and mole-like retreat into computers to make her an object of frequent ridicule. She joined the army in a bid to get enough money to go to college. The hyper-masculine culture of the military, where hazing is frequent, and some of the soldiers and Marines targeted for physical and verbal abuse in foreign deployment commit suicide, saw Manning mistreated from the moment she enlisted. "He was a runt, so pick on him," remembers a soldier who spoke to The Guardian, but did not want to give his name. "He's crazy, so pick on him. He's a faggot. Pick on him. The guy took it from every side. He couldn't please anyone. He was targeted by bullies. He was targeted by the drill sergeants. Basically, he was targeted by anybody who was within arm's reach. There were three guys that had him up front and cornered, and they were picking on him, and he was yelling and screaming back," remembered this soldier from Memphis. "And I'm yelling at the guys, 'Get the hell out of here, back off,' and everything. I start to pull Manning off. The other guys were taking care of the ones that were picking on him and stuff. And I got Manning off to the side there, and, yeah, he'd pissed himself. That wasn't the only time he did that. I was in the small courtroom at Fort Meade in Maryland to hear the sentencing by Army Colonel Judge Denise Lind of then Private First Class Bradley Manning to 35 years in prison. Manning's sentence once again confirmed the inversion of our moral and legal order, the capitulation of the press, and the misuse of the law to prevent any oversight or investigation of official abuses of power, including war crimes. The sentencing of Manning marked the day when the state formally declared that all who name and expose its crimes will become political prisoners or will be forced, like Snowden, to flee into exile. State power, the sentence showed us, will be unaccountable. And those who do not accept unlimited state power, always the road to tyranny, will be persecuted. Two burly guards who towered over Manning hustled her out of a military courtroom at Fort Meade after the 2-minute sentencing. I listened to half a dozen of Manning's supporters shout, "We'll keep fighting for you, Bradley. You're our hero." Manning, if we had a functioning judiciary, would have been a witness for the prosecution against the war criminals she helped expose. She would not have been headed, bound, and shackled to the military prison at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. But the government effectively shut down Manning's defense team. The Army private was not permitted to argue that she had a moral and legal obligation under international law to defy military orders and to make public the war crimes she had uncovered. Because the documents that detailed the crimes, torture, and killing that Manning revealed were classified, they were barred from discussion in court, and so the fundamental issue of war crimes was effectively removed from the trial. Manning was forbidden to challenge the government's unverified assertion that she had harmed national security. Lead defense attorney David E. Coombs said during pretrial proceedings that the judge's refusal to permit information on the lack of actual damage from the leaks would eliminate a viable defense and cut defense off at the knees. And that is what happened. Manning was also barred from presenting to the court her motives for giving WikiLeaks hundreds of thousands of classified diplomatic cables, war logs from Afghanistan and Iraq, and videos. The issues of her motives and the potential harm to national security could be raised only at the time of sentencing, but by then it was too late. Coombs opened the trial by pleading with the judge for leniency, based on Manning's youth and sincerity. Coombs was permitted by Lind to present only circumstantial evidence concerning Manning's motives or state of mind. He could argue, for example, that Manning did not know Al-Qaeda might see the information she leaked. Coombs was also permitted to argue, as he did, that Manning was selective in her leak, intending no harm to national interests. But these were minor concessions by the court to the defense. Manning's most impassioned pleas for freedom of information, expressed in email exchanges with a confidential government informant, Lamo, were never permitted to be heard in court. These restrictions prevented Manning from appealing to the Nuremberg Principles, a set of guidelines created by the International Law Commission of the United Nations after World War II to determine what constitutes a war crime. The principles make political leaders, commanders, and combatants responsible for war crimes, even if domestic or internal laws allow such actions. The Nuremberg Principles are designed to protect those, like Manning, who expose these crimes. Under the Nuremberg Principles, military orders do not offer an excuse for committing war crimes, and the Nuremberg Principles would clearly exonerate Manning and condemn the pilots shown in the collateral murder video, who fired on unarmed civilians in Baghdad, leaving 12 dead, including the two Reuters journalists. He, Manning, knew that the video depicted a 2007 attack, Coombs said of the collateral murder video. He knew that it, the attack, resulted in the death of two journalists. And because it resulted in the death of two journalists, it had received worldwide attention. He knew that the organization Reuters had requested a copy of the video in FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, because it was their two journalists that were killed, and they wanted to have that copy in order to find out what had happened and to ensure that it didn't happen again. He knew that the United States had responded to that FOIA request almost 2 years later, indicating what they could find and, notably, not the video. Coombs continued, he knew that David Finkel, an author, had written a book called The Good Soldiers, and when he read through David Finkel's account and he talked about this incident that's depicted in the video, he saw that David Finkel's account and the actual video were verbatim, that David Finkel was quoting the Apache air crew. And so at that point, he knew that David Finkel had a copy of the video. And when he decided to release this information, he believed that this information showed how little we valued human life in Iraq. He was troubled by that, and he believed that if the American public saw it, they too would be troubled, and maybe things would change. He was 22 years old, Coombs said as he stood near the bench, speaking quietly to the judge at the close of his opening statement. He was young. He was a little naive in believing that the information that he selected could actually make a difference. But he was good-intentioned in that he was selecting information that he hoped would make a difference. He wasn't selecting information because it was wanted by WikiLeaks, Coombs concluded. He wasn't selecting information because of some 2009 most wanted list. He was selecting information because he believed that this information needed to be public. At the time that he released the information, he was concentrating on what the American public would think about that information, not whether or not the enemy would get access to it, and he had absolutely no knowledge of whether the enemy would gain access to it. Young, naive, but good-intentioned. I believed if the public, particularly the American public, could see this, it could spark a debate on the military and our foreign policy in general as it applied to Iraq and Afghanistan, Manning said on February 28, 2013, when she pleaded guilty to the lesser charges, her back to a few dozen of us, including Cornel West, who made it into the courtroom as she faced the judge. She said that she had hoped the release of the information to WikiLeaks might cause society to reconsider the need to engage in counterterrorism while ignoring the situation of the people we engaged with every day. But it has not. Our mechanical drones still circle the skies, delivering death. Our attack jets still blast civilians. Our soldiers and Marines still pump bullets into mud-walled villages. Our artillery and missiles still raise homes. Our torturers still torture. Our politicians and generals still lie. And the soldier who tried to stop it all is serving a 35-year prison sentence. The Afghans, the Iraqis, the Yemenis, the Pakistanis, and the Somalis know what American military forces do. They do not need to read WikiLeaks. It is we who remain ignorant. Our terror is delivered daily to the wretched of the earth with industrial weapons. But to us, it is invisible. We do not stand over the decapitated and eviscerated bodies left behind on city and village streets by our missiles, drones, and fighter jets. We do not listen to the wails and shrieks of parents embracing the shattered bodies of their children. We do not see the survivors of air attacks bury their mothers, fathers, brothers, and sisters. We are not conscious of the long night of collective humiliation, repression, and powerlessness that characterizes existence in Israel's occupied territories, Iraq, and Afghanistan. We do not see the boiling anger that war and injustice turn into a cauldron of hate over time. We are not aware of the very natural lust for revenge against those who carry out or symbolize this oppression. We see only the final pyrotechnics of terror. The shocking moment when the rage erupts into an inchoate fury and the murder of innocence. And willfully uninformed, we do not understand our own complicity. We self-righteously condemn the killers as subhuman savages who deserve more of the violence that created them. This is a recipe for endless terror. Manning, by providing a window into the truth, opened up the possibility of redemption. She offered hope for a new relationship with a Muslim world, one based on compassion and honesty, on the rule of law, rather than on the cold brutality of industrial warfare. But by refusing to heed the truth that Manning laid before us, by ignoring the crimes committed daily in our name, we not only continue to swell the ranks of our enemies, but put the lives of our citizens in greater and greater jeopardy. Manning showed us through the documents she released to WikiLeaks what all Iraqis know. They have endured hundreds of rapes and murders, along with systematic torture by the military and police of the puppet government we installed. None of the atrocities from the leaked videos and documents were investigated. Manning provided the data showing that between 2004 and 2009, there were at least 109,032 violent deaths in Iraq, including those of 66,081 civilians, and that coalition troops were responsible for at least 195 unreported civilian deaths. In the collateral murder video, she allowed us to watch as a U.S. helicopter attacked unarmed civilians in Baghdad and as a U.S. Army tank then crushed one of the wounded lying on the street. The actions of the U.S. military in this one video alone, as law professor Marjorie Cohn has pointed out, violate Article 85 of the First Protocol to the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits the targeting of civilians. Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which requires that the wounded be treated, and Article 17 of the First Protocol, which permits civilians to rescue and care for the wounded without being harmed. David Coombs read a brief statement from the 25-year-old Manning after the sentencing. "The decisions that I made in 2010 were made out of a concern for my country and the world that we live in. Since the tragic events of 9/11, our country has been at war. We've been at war with an enemy that chooses not to meet us on any traditional battlefield, and due to this fact, we've had to alter our methods of combating the risks posed to us and our way of life. I initially agreed with these methods and chose to volunteer to help defend my country. It was not until I was in Iraq and reading secret military reports on a daily basis that I started to question the morality of what we were doing. It was at this time I realized in our efforts to meet this risk posed to us by the enemy, we have forgotten our humanity. We consciously elected to devalue human life both in Iraq and Afghanistan. When we engaged those that we perceived were the enemy, we sometimes killed innocent civilians. Whenever we killed innocent civilians, instead of accepting responsibility for our conduct, we elected to hide behind the veil of national security and classified information in order to avoid any public accountability. In our zeal to kill the enemy, we internally debated the definition of torture. We held individuals at Guantanamo for years without due process. We inexplicably turned a blind eye to torture and executions by the Iraqi government, and we stomached countless other acts in the name of our war on terror. Patriotism is often the cry extolled when morally questionable acts are advocated by those in power. When these cries of patriotism drown out any logically based dissension, it is usually the American soldier that is given the order to carry out some ill-conceived mission. Our nation has had similar dark moments for the virtues of democracy: the Trail of Tears, the Dred Scott decision, McCarthyism, and the Japanese-American internment camps, to mention a few. I am confident that many of the actions since 9/11 will one day be viewed in a similar light. As the late Howard Zinn once said, there is not a flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people. I understand that my actions violated the law. I regret if my actions hurt anyone or harmed the United States. It was never my intent to hurt anyone. I only wanted to help people. When I chose to disclose classified information, I did so out of a love for my country and a sense of duty to others. If you deny my request for a pardon, I will serve my time knowing that sometimes you have to pay a heavy price to live in a free society. I will gladly pay that price if it means we could have a country that is truly conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all women and men are created equal. I sat in the front row of a New York federal court in November 2013, the day Jeremy Hammond was sentenced to 10 years in prison for hacking into the computers of a private security firm that works on behalf of the government, including the Department of Homeland Security, the Marine Corps, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and corporations such as Dow Chemical and Raytheon. Hammond, then aged 26, released to WikiLeaks, Rolling Stone, and other publications some 5 million emails in 2011 from the Texas-based company Strategic Forecasting, Inc., or Stratfor. His four co-defendants, convicted in Great Britain, were sentenced to less time combined. The longest sentence was 32 months, than the 120-month sentence meted out to Hammond. The 5 million email exchanges, once made public, exposed the private security firm's infiltration, monitoring, and surveillance of protesters and dissidents on behalf of corporations and the national security state. And perhaps most importantly, the information provided chilling evidence that anti-terrorism laws are being routinely used by the state to criminalize nonviolent democratic dissent and falsely link dissidents to international terrorist organizations. Hammond sought no financial gain. He got none. The email exchanges Hammond provided to the public were entered as evidence in my lawsuit against Barack Obama over Section 1021(b)(2) of the National Defense Authorization Act. One of my co-plaintiffs was Alexa O'Brien, a journalist and content strategist who co-founded the U.S. Day of Rage, an organization created to reform the election process. Because of the Hammond leaks, we know that Stratfor officials attempted to falsely link her and her organization to Islamic radicals and websites as well as jihadist ideology, setting her up for detention under the new law. U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest ruled, in part because of the leak, that we did as plaintiffs have a credible fear, and she nullified the law, a ruling that the higher appellate court overturned when the Obama administration appealed her ruling. Hammond's 10-year sentence was one of the longest in U.S. history for hacking. It was the maximum the judge could impose under a plea agreement in the case. It was wildly disproportionate to the crime, an act of nonviolent civil disobedience that championed the public good by exposing abuses of power by the government and a security firm. But the excessive sentence was the point. I met Hammond in Manhattan's Metropolitan Correctional Center about a week and a half before his sentencing. He was wearing an oversized brown prison jumpsuit that fell over his shoes. He had long brown hair and a wispy beard. He had been held for 20 months. "People have a right to know what governments and corporations are doing behind closed doors," he said. Judge Preska, who sentenced Hammond with the same venom she displayed in sentencing Syed Fahad Hashmi, is a member of the right-wing Federalist Society. And the hack into Stratford disclosed the email address and password for a business account of Preska's husband, Thomas Cavaller, a partner at the law firm Cahill, Gordon & Rindell. Some emails of the firm's corporate clients, including Merrill Lynch, also were exposed. The National Lawyers Guild, because the judge's husband was a victim of the hack, filed a recusal motion. Preska, as chief judge of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, and therefore the final authority, was able to deny it. Her refusal to recuse herself allowed her to oversee a trial in which she had allegedly a huge conflict of interest. The judge, who herself was once employed at Cahill, Gordon & Rindell, fulminated from the bench about Hammond's total lack of respect for the law. She read a laundry list of his arrests for acts of civil disobedience. She damned what she called his unrepentant recidivism. She said, "These are not the actions of Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, or even Daniel Ellsberg," an odd analogy given that Mandela founded the armed wing of the African National Congress, was considered a terrorist by South Africa's apartheid government and the U.S. government, and was vilified along with King and Ellsberg by the U.S. government. Preska said that there was a desperate need to promote respect for the law and a need for adequate public deterrence. She read from transcripts of Hammond's conversations in anonymous chat rooms in which he described the goal of hacking into Stratfor as destroying the target, hoping for bankruptcy, collapse, and called for maximum mayhem. She admonished him for releasing the unlisted phone number of a retired Arizona police official who allegedly received threatening phone calls afterward. The judge, in addition to the 10-year sentence, imposed equally harsh measures for after Hammond's release from prison. She ordered that he be placed under 3 years of supervised control, be forbidden to use encryption or aliases online, and submit to random searches of his computer equipment, person, and home by police and any internal security agency without the necessity of a warrant. The judge said that Hammond was legally banned from having any contact with electronic civil disobedience websites or organizations. The sentence required the judge to demonstrate a callous disregard for transparency and our right to privacy. It required her to ignore the disturbing information Hammond released, showing that the government and Stratfor had attempted to link nonviolent dissident groups, including some within Occupy, to terrorist organizations so that peaceful dissidents could be prosecuted as terrorists. It required her to accept the frightening fact that intelligence agencies now work on behalf of corporations as well as the state. She also had to sidestep the fact that Hammond made no financial gain from the leak. Hammond's draconian sentence, like the draconian sentences of other whistleblowers, will fan open defiance of the state. It will solidify the growing understanding that we must resort, if we want to effect real change, to unconventional and illegal tactics to thwart the mounting abuses by the corporate state. There is no hope, this sentencing showed, for redress from the judicial system, elected officials, or the executive branch. Why should we respect a court system or a governmental system that does not respect us? Why should we abide by laws that protect only criminals like Wall Street thieves while leaving the rest of us exposed to abuse? Why should we continue to have faith in structures of power that deny us our most basic rights and civil liberties? Why should we be impoverished so that the profits of big banks, corporations, and hedge funds can swell? Hammond, 6 feet tall and wiry, defined himself when we met in jail as an anarchist communist. He said he had dedicated his life to destroying capitalism and the centralized power of the corporate state, and that he embraced the classic tools of revolt, including mass protests, general strikes, and boycotts. And he saw hacking and leaking as critical tools of this resistance, to be used not only to reveal the truths about systems of corporate power, but to disrupt/destroy these systems entirely. Like Assange and Manning, Jeremy Hammond had an unconventional childhood. He and his twin brother Jason were raised by their single father, Jack, in Glendale Heights, Illinois, in a working-class suburb in western Chicago. His mother, Rose, left the family when the twins were three. While she provided some financial support, she left most of the child-rearing to Jack. Hammond's father was an aspiring punk rock musician who dropped out of high school and earned about $35,000 a year giving guitar lessons. Jeremy showed an early and precocious talent for computers, as well as politics. He responded to the war jingoism that enveloped the country after the 9/11 attacks by organizing school protests against the calls to invade Iraq. He founded an underground newspaper that was designed, as he wrote in the first editor's letter, to get students to most of all think. Wake up. Your mind is programmable. If you're not programming your mind, someone else will program it for you. My first memories of American politics was when Bush stole the election in 2000, he told me. And then how Bush used the wave of nationalism after 9/11 to launch unprovoked preemptive wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. In high school, I was involved in publishing underground newsletters criticizing the Patriot Act, the wars, and other Bush-era policies. I attended many anti-war protests in the city, Chicago, and was introduced to other local struggles and the larger anti-corporate globalization movement. I began identifying as an anarchist, started to travel around the country to various mobilizations and conferences, and began getting arrested for various acts. He said that his experience of street protest, especially against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, was seminal, for he saw that the state had little interest in heeding the voices of protesters and other public voices. Instead, we were labeled as traitors, beaten, and arrested. Hammond was living at home in Chicago in 2010 under a curfew from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. for a variety of acts of civil disobedience when Manning was arrested. Like Manning, he had shown an astonishing aptitude for science, math, and the language of computers from a very young age. He hacked into the computers at a local Apple store when he was 16 and then showed the stunned sales staff how he had done it. When he hacked into the computer science department's website at the University of Illinois Chicago as a freshman, the university responded to this prank by refusing to allow him to return for his sophomore year. He was an early backer of cyber liberation, and in 2004 started an electronic disobedience journal he named Hack This Zine. That same year, Hammond called on hackers in a speech at the DEF CON convention in Las Vegas, the largest and best-known underground hacking conference, to use their skills to disrupt the upcoming Republican National Convention. By the time of his arrest, Hammond was one of the shadowy stars of the hacktivist underground. He was also the FBI's number one most wanted cyber criminal in the world. It was Manning's courage that prompted Hammond to commit his own act of cyber civil disobedience, although he knew the chances of being caught were high. "I saw what Chelsea Manning did," he said when we spoke, seated at a metal table in a tiny room reserved for attorney-client visits. Through her hacking, she became a contender, a world changer. She took tremendous risks to show the ugly truth about war. I asked myself, if she could make that risk, shouldn't I make that risk? Wasn't it wrong to sit comfortably by, working on the websites of Food, Not Bombs, while I had the skills to do something similar? I too could make a difference. It was her courage that prompted me to act. Hammond, with black tattoos on each forearm, one a grid-like glider symbol that was proposed by computer programmer Eric S. Raymond as a symbol for the hacker subculture, and the other the Xi hexagram from the I Ching, meaning leading or army or troops, is steeped in radical thought. He swiftly migrated politically as a young teenager from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party to the militancy of Black Bloc anarchists. He was an avid reader in high school of material put out by CrimeThink, an anarchist collective that publishes anarchist literature and manifestos, including the Anarchist Cookbook. Hammond is steeped in the work of old radicals, from Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman to black revolutionaries such as George Jackson, Elaine Brown, and Assata Shakur. He admires the Weather Underground. Hammond told me he made numerous trips while in Chicago to Forest Home Cemetery to visit the Haymarket Martyrs Monument, which honors anarchists who took part in the labor wars, four of whom were hanged in 1887. On the 16-foot-high granite monument are the final words of one of the condemned men, August Spies. "The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voice you are throttling today." Emma Goldman is buried nearby. Hammond became well known to the state for a variety of acts of civil disobedience over the last decade, ranging from painting anti-war graffiti on walls in Chicago to protesting at the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York, to hacking into the right-wing website Protest Warrior, for which he was sentenced to 2 years at Federal Correctional Institution, FCI, Greenville, in Illinois. He told me that his goal was to build leaderless collectives based on free association, consensus, mutual aid, self-sufficiency, and harmony with the environment. "It is essential," he said, "that all of us work to cut our personal ties with capitalism and engage in resistance that includes mass organizing of protests, strikes, and boycotts, as well as hacking and leaking, which are effective tools to reveal ugly truths of the system or to disrupt/destroy these systems entirely." Hammond spent months within the Occupy movement in Chicago. He embraced its leaderless, non-hierarchical structures, such as general assemblies and consensus, and occupying public spaces. But he was critical of what he said was Occupy's vague politics, which allowed it to include followers of Ron Paul and some in the Tea Party, as well as reformist liberals and Democrats. Hammond said he was not interested in a movement that only wanted a nicer form of capitalism and favored legal reforms, not revolution. He said he did not support what he called a dogmatic nonviolence doctrine held by many in the Occupy movement, describing it as needlessly limited and divisive. He rejected the idea of protesters carrying out acts of civil disobedience that they know will lead to arrest. "The point," he said, "is to carry out acts of resistance and not get caught." He condemned the peace patrols, units formed within the Occupy movement that sought to prohibit acts of vandalism and violence by other protesters, most often members of the Black Bloc, as a secondary police force. Furthermore, Hammond dismissed the call by many in Occupy not to antagonize the police, whom he characterized as the boot boys of the 1%, paid to protect the rich and powerful. He said such a tactic of non-confrontation with the police ignored the long history of repression by the police in attacking popular movements, as well as the profiling and imprisonment of our comrades. He went on, "Because we were unprepared, or perhaps unwilling, to defend our occupations, police and mayors launched coordinated attacks, driving us out of our own parks. I fully support and have participated in Black Bloc and other forms of militant direct action," he said. "I do not believe that the ruling powers listen to the people's peaceful protests. Black Bloc is an effective, fluid, and dynamic form of protest. It causes disruption outside of predictable/controllable mass demonstrations through unarrests, holding streets, barricades, and property destruction. Smashing corporate windows is not violence, especially when compared to the everyday economic violence of sweatshops and free trade. Black Bloc seeks to hit them where it hurts, through economic damage. But more than smashing windows, they seek to break the spell of law and order and the artificial limitations we impose on ourselves." When he was sentenced, Hammond told the courtroom, "The acts of civil disobedience that I am being sentenced for today are in line with the principles of community and equality that have guided my life. I hacked into dozens of high-profile corporations and government institutions, understanding very clearly that what I was doing was against the law and that my actions could land me back in federal prison. But I felt that I had an obligation to use my skills to expose and confront injustice and to bring the truth to light. Could I have achieved the same goals through legal means?" he asked the court. "I have tried everything from voting petitions to peaceful protest and have found that those in power do not want the truth to be exposed. When we speak truth to power, we are ignored at best and brutally suppressed at worst. We are confronting a power structure that does not respect its own system of checks and balances, never mind the rights of its own citizens or the international community. I targeted law enforcement systems because of the racism and inequality with which the criminal law is enforced, he admitted in court. I targeted the manufacturers and distributors of military and police equipment who profit from weaponry used to advance U.S. political and economic interests abroad and to repress people at home. I targeted information security firms because they work in secret to protect government and corporate interests at the expense of individual rights, undermining and discrediting activists, journalists, and other truth seekers, and spreading disinformation. Why the FBI would introduce us to the hacker Sabu, who found the initial vulnerability, and allow this hack to continue remains a mystery, Hammond said as he faced the judge. As a result of the Stratfor hack, some of the dangers of the unregulated private intelligence industry are now known. It has been revealed through WikiLeaks and other journalists around the world that Stratfor maintained a worldwide network of informants that they used to engage in intrusive and possibly illegal surveillance activities on behalf of large multinational corporations. At Sabu's urging, Hammond broke into other websites too. Hammond, at Sabu's request, provided information to hackers that enabled them to break into and deface official foreign government websites, including those of Turkey, Iran, and Brazil. I broke into numerous sites and handed over passwords and backdoors that enabled Sabu, and by extension his FBI handlers, to control these targets, Hammond said. I don't know how other information I provided to him may have been used, but I think the government's collection and use of this data needs to be investigated, he went on. The government celebrates my conviction and imprisonment, hoping that it will close the door on the full story. I took responsibility for my actions by pleading guilty, but when will the government be made to answer for its crimes? The hypocrisy of law and order and the injustices caused by capitalism cannot be cured by institutional reform, but through civil disobedience and direct action, Hammond told the court. Yes, I broke the law. But I believe that sometimes laws must be broken in order to make room for change. As Hammond was escorted out of the courtroom on the ninth floor of the federal courthouse at 500 Pearl Street after the sentencing, he shouted to roughly 100 people, including a class of prim West Point cadets attending in their blue uniforms, gathered there, "Long live Anonymous! Hurrah for anarchy!" In a statement he read in court, he thanked Free Anons, the Anonymous Solidarity Network, and Anarchist Black Cross for their roles in the fight against oppression. Being incarcerated has really opened my eyes to the reality of the criminal justice system, Hammond told me in the jail. It is not a criminal justice system about public safety or rehabilitation, but reaping profits through mass incarceration. There are two kinds of justice, one for the rich and the powerful who get away with the big crimes, then one for everyone else, especially people of color and the impoverished. There is no such thing as a fair trial. In over 80% of the cases, people are pressured to plea out instead of exercising their right to trial, under the threat of lengthier sentences. I believe no satisfactory reforms are possible. We need to close all prisons and release everybody unconditionally. After committing a series of minor infractions, as well as testing positive along with other prisoners on his tier for marijuana that had been smuggled into the prison, Hammond had already lost social visits for the next 2 years and spent time in the box. He said prison involved a lot of boredom. He was playing a lot of chess, teaching guitar, and helping other prisoners study for their GED. He insisted that he did not see himself as different from other prisoners, especially poor prisoners of color, who were in for common crimes, especially drug-related crimes. He said that most prisoners are political prisoners, caged unjustly by a system of totalitarian capitalism that has snuffed out basic opportunities for democratic dissent and economic survival. The majority of people in prison did what they had to do to survive, he said. Most were poor. They got caught up in the war on drugs, which is how you make money if you were poor. The real reason they get locked in prison for so long is so corporations can continue to make big profits. It is not about justice. I do not draw distinctions between us. Jail is essentially enduring harassment and dehumanizing conditions with frequent lockdowns and shakedowns, he said. You have to constantly fight for respect from the guards, sometimes getting yourself thrown in the box. However, I will not change the way I live because I am locked up. I will continue to be defiant, agitating and organizing whenever possible. He said resistance must be a way of life. The truth, he said, will always come out. He cautioned activists to be hypervigilant and aware that one mistake can be permanent. Activists should know and accept the worst possible repercussion before carrying out an action and should be aware of mass counterintelligence/surveillance operations targeting our movements. But, he added, don't let paranoia or fear deter you from activism. Do the down thing. In these times of secrecy and abuse of power, there is only one solution, transparency, wrote Sarah Harrison, the British journalist who accompanied Snowden to Russia and who has also gone into self-imposed exile in Berlin. If our governments are so compromised that they will not tell us the truth, then we must step forward to grasp it. Provided with the unequivocal proof of primary source documents, people can fight back. If our governments will not give this information to us, then we must take it for ourselves. When whistleblowers come forward, we need to fight for them so others will be encouraged, she went on. When they are gagged, we must be their voice. When they are hunted, we must be their shield. When they are locked away, we must free them. Giving us the truth is not a crime. This is our data, our information, our history. We must fight to own it. Courage is contagious. I walked down Sloane Street in London after I left Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. Red double-decker buses and automobiles inched along the thoroughfare. I passed boutiques with window displays of Prada, Armani, and Gucci. The global super-rich, seeking a tax haven, have colonized this section of London. The area has the highest household income in the United Kingdom. Much of London's housing wealth now lies in the hands of a global elite for whom the city represents not a home, but a tax haven attached to an exclusive resort town, a Financial Times editorial bemoaned. Shoppers who seemed blissfully unaware of the tragedy unfolding a few blocks away crowded the sidewalk. I stopped in front of the four white columns that led into the brick-turreted Cadogan Hotel. The Cadogan is where Oscar Wilde was arrested in room 118 on April 6, 1895, before being charged with committing acts of gross indecency with other male persons. John Betjeman imagined the shock of that arrest, which ruined Wilde's life, in his 1937 poem, The Arrest of Oscar Wilde at the Cadogan Hotel. A thump and a murmur of voices. Oh, why must they make such a din? As the door of the bedroom swung open and two plainclothes policemen came in. Mr. Wilde, we have come for to take you where felons and criminals dwell. We must ask you to leave with us quietly, for this is the Cadogan Hotel. The world has been turned upside down. The pestilence of corporate totalitarianism is spreading over the earth. The criminals have seized power. It is not only Assange, Hammond, Abu Jamal, Manning, and Hashmi they want. It is all who dare to defy the destructive fury of the global corporate state. The persecution of these rebels is the harbinger of what is to come, the rise of a bitter world where criminals in tailored suits and gangsters in beribboned military uniforms, propped up by a vast internal and external security apparatus, a compliant press, and a morally bankrupt political elite hunt down and cage all who resist.